Part 1. Lavender Lodge. 1. I think it was only at the very end of the Lavender Lodge job, when we were fighting for our lives in that unholy guest house, that I glimpsed Lockwood & Co. working together perfectly for the first time. It was just the briefest flash, but every detail remains etched into my memory. Those moments of sweet precision when we truly acted as a team. Yes, every detail. Anthony Lockwood, coat aflame, arms flapping madly as he staggered back towards the open window. George Cubbins, dangling from the ladder one-handed like an oversized windblown pear. And me, Lucy Carlyle, bruised, bloody, and covered in cobwebs, sprinting, jumping, rolling desperately to avoid the ghostly coils. Sure, I know none of that sounds so great, and to be fair, we could have done without George's squeaking. But this was the thing about Lockwood & Co. We made the most of unpromising situations and turned them to our advantage. Want to know how? I'll show you. 6 hours earlier, there we were, on the doorstep, ringing the bell. It was a dreary, storm-soaked November afternoon, with the shadows deepening and the rooftops of Old Whitechapel showing sharp and black against the clouds. Rain spotted our coats and glistened on the blades of our rapiers. The clocks had just struck 4.
"Everyone ready?" Lockwood asked. "Remember, we ask them some questions, we keep careful psychic watch. If we get any clues to the murder room or the location of the bodies, we don't let on. We just say goodbye politely and head off to fetch the police."
"That's fine," I said. George, busily adjusting his work belt, nodded.
"It's a useless plan."
The hoarse whisper came from somewhere close behind my ear.
"I say stab them first, ask questions later. That's your only sensible option."
I nudged my rucksack with an elbow.
"Shut up. I thought you wanted my advice."
"Your job is to keep lookout, not distract us with stupid theories. Now hush." We waited on the step. The Lavender Lodge boarding house was a narrow, terrace building of 3 floors. Like most of this part of London's East End, it had a weary, ground-down air. Soot crusted the pebble-dash render. Thin curtains dangled at the windows. No light showed in the upper stories, but the hall light was on, and there was a yellowed vacancies sign propped behind the panel of cracked glass in the centre of the door. Lockwood squinted through the glass, shielding his eyes with his gloved hand.
"Well, somebody's at home," he said. "I can see 2 people standing at the far end of the hall."
He pressed the buzzer again. It was an ugly sound, a razor to the ear. He rapped the knocker too. No one came.
"Hope they put their skates on," George said. "I don't want to worry you or anything, but there's something white creeping towards us up the street."
He was right. Far off in the dusk, a pale form could just be seen. It drifted slowly above the pavement in the shadows of the houses, coming in our direction. Lockwood shrugged. He didn't even bother looking.
"Oh, it's probably just a shirt flapping on someone's line. It's still early. Won't be anything nasty yet."
George and I glanced at one another. It was that time of year when the days were scarcely lighter than the nights, and the dead began walking during the darkest afternoons. On the way over from the tube, in fact, we'd seen a shade on Whitechapel High Road, a faint twist of darkness standing brokenly in the gutter, being spun and buffeted by the tailwinds of the last cars hurrying home. So nasty things were out already, as Lockwood well knew.
"Since when has a flapping shirt had a head and spindly legs attached?" George asked.
He took off his glasses.